internet, and you don't have to know anything about how computers work or the internet, but you just use it. That was a really good idea, because the internet was the big thing then. John Rubinstein. The network computer evolved into the iMac, which was a very, very successful product for us. Tom Suter. I'll never forget the day he grabbed us and said, I've got a little something I want to show you guys. And so we leave the Mariani building and bounce across the street and go over to where Johnny Ive's studio was. And there are these things with shrouds on them, and in a typical P.T. Barnum way, he pulls off the coverings, and it's the iMac in 5 lifesaver color versions. Andy Grignon. That got Apple on people's radars again, because computers at the time were boring beige boxes. Even at Apple in the mid-90s, we made boring beige boxes. Larry Ellison. Steve Jobs picked the colors of the original iMacs. Sorry, no beige. Tom Suter. And they're so cool and translucent, and it's like something from outer space. And I remember saying, I just want to lick them. Michael Dewey. It was sort of back to the future. The iMac was kind of the replacement for the Apple II. John Rubinstein. That was the beginning of the turnaround for Apple. Mike Slade. And by late 98 or early 99, they had $4 billion in the bank. But it wasn't iMacs, okay? The iMac didn't make any money. It was mostly the expensive towers. The next campaign after Think Different was this thing where they make fun of Intel. And that's because Steve was trying to appeal to the Photoshop weenies and get them to buy overpriced G3 and G4 towers. Okay, it was also PowerBooks, but mostly towers. It's really simple, right? Sell the high gross margin stuff. It might as well be a clothing store. It took 18 months for Apple to get back on its feet. Meanwhile, Tony Fadell, the young engineer who had cut his teeth at General Magic, was trying to get his own company off the ground. The idea was to do a line of MP3 players. Guy Barnahum. I remember Tony walking around like a loser in the valley with a secret in his pocket. He's the guy that had in his brain these two ideas, MP3s plus storage. There was a time when he was alone in the world with this. He was going around the valley looking for people who would tolerate him, who would give him space, physical space to sit in and draw. Eve Behar. Tony had just come out of General Magic, and we had a meeting in South Park, and Tony got really, really animated and passionate and excited about digital music and moving forward. Essentially, he was founding a company, and he wanted to go investigate the hardware and the software that could live around digital media. Tony Fadell. Hardware plus software plus services. General Magic was the first link that I ever saw like that. That influenced me for everything I did in my career since. Eve Behar. And he raised money from Samsung, and we took a space on Broadway in Columbus and started sketching and drawing different hardware, and essentially a whole line of products. Everything from home stereo systems to portable systems to DVRs. The whole product line would have a minimum amount of connectors and a very simple interface. The way Tony saw it was, let's create a whole ecosystem of products that will replace the entirety of your home audio and video components. And one of those things was a small portable MP3 music player. Guy Barnahum. Tony was like a guy with a secret in his pocket walking around like, look at this. Look at this. I have the iPod. He didn't call it the iPod, and there were a lot of missing pieces, right? But that basic enabling idea, he had it first. Eve Behar. We had designed the whole system of products to be square with a circular interface that you sort of navigate around, basically a circle within a square. It was a design that we had scaled down to a small portable player and up to a nice little cube stereo system. Tony Fadell. I never went off to the internet. When everyone went off to the internet, I stayed doing devices. Eve Behar. We had made a lot of progress. We had a great product lineup. We had some hardware designed and we had some mock-ups. The technology was aligning. Tony Fadell. And then the internet crunch happened. Eve Behar. Just as it was for everyone else, it was impossible to find money to fund the next round for the company. Tony Fadell. No one wanted to fund it. They were like, you are crazy. You should only be doing software. Hardware is dead, blah, blah, blah. Eve Behar. There was a belief back then that hardware would disappear. Hardware was going to be totally annihilated by web pages, the internet, e-commerce. Silicon Valley was focused on the internet, but Apple had hardware coded in its DNA. And Jobs, like Fadell, awoke to the opportunity that Napster had created. Sean Parker. At the time, there may have been as many as 400 million people actively trading MP3s and listening to music on their computers, and that meant there was a market for this thing called an iPod. John Rubinstein. Battery technology, as well as display technology driven by cell phones, was maturing, and so I kept going to Steve and going, you know, Steve, I can't do a better music player yet. The trade-off was this. You get a large hard drive and a lot of songs, and it was huge and heavy and delicate, or it was really tiny and held 5 or 10 songs, so neither of those products made sense. And so in February of 2001, I'm over in Japan for Macworld Tokyo, and every time I'm in Japan, I go visit all the vendors. There was a handful of us that went on these supplier visits. We visited battery manufacturers because we need batteries for the notebook, and visited display manufacturers because we use displays for a lot of things, and we visited hard drive manufacturers because we use hard drives everywhere. And so we got to Toshiba. We had a meeting, and we went through the hard drives for all the different products. And at the end of the meeting, they go, oh, by the way, we've got this other thing we're working on, but we don't know what to do with it. And that was the small form factor hard drive. Guy Barnahum. Now, it's still a mystery to me why Toshiba made a 1.8-inch diameter drive with 5 gigs capacity. Only the Japanese, God bless them, do things like that sometimes. They make a piece of technology that doesn't have any justification in the market. At the time, there was no industry to justify that illogical decision. The whole arc of development of the hard drive was for laptops, not handhelds. John Rubinstein. So I went back to Steve and I said, Steve, I think we can do this. The drives won't be ready until late in 2001, but this is now doable. We can build a really cool product. It will be about the size of a pack of cards. And I need $10 million to do it because I need to assemble a team and go build this out. Steve said, no problem, I'll write you a check. So I called Fred Anderson, the CTO, and made sure the check wouldn't bounce because you always had to double check with Fred. And Fred said, the check is good. And so we started assembling a team to do it. Tony Fadell. So I'm getting on a ski lift in Vail and I get this call. Hi, this is John Rubinstein from Apple, blah, blah, blah. The very next week, I had my first meeting with John. John Rubinstein. I said, hey, I've got this project I need some help on. I didn't tell him what it was, but I said, it's a small consumer form factor product. Tony Fadell. I thought they wanted me to restart Newton or something, so I didn't know what it was, and they wouldn't tell me. Then, after I signed the NDA, it was, we have iTunes. Now we want iTunes on the go. The MP3 players out there today suck, and we think we can make a better one. We know you make these kinds of devices, so can you come in and sketch what you would build? Eve Behar. And then one day Tony said, you know, I'm going to take a contract. I'm going to work with Steve Jobs for 6 weeks. And if I can deliver this project for Steve in 6 weeks, we'll see what happens. John Rubinstein. I hired him as a consultant, and it was, here's what we've been looking at, and so now go thrash out what's available to make all this happen. Tony Fadell. I said okay, and then I worked nights, weekends, all day, and I let my startup company just run, and I went off and dove into trying to design what would become the iPod. So I had to learn about new chips and all the different things and put it together. What I remembered from my General Magic days is that you have to make sure that you do a lot of due diligence before going in, because if you commit to something, they are going to expect that that is the way it turns out. So I did a ton of due diligence. I did as much as I could in that short amount of time. 6 weeks later, I pitched it to Steve. John Rubenstein. There was a key meeting. It's me and Phil Schiller and Johnny. There was a group of us, but Tony is the lead. Tony Fidel. Steve comes in the room, does not say a word, takes the checklist, throws it on the desk, and gives the vision for it. Ron Johnson. It was, I want to make a music device, and I want it to hold all your music. I want it to be digital with great software so you could take your music everywhere. I don't think he had thought of 1,000 songs in your pocket yet, but that was what he was imagining. Larry Ellison. He was obsessive about making an MP3 player easy to use and affordable and beautiful. All the things you'd think Sony would do. Tony Fidel. Then we flipped to the next page of the checklist, and there was something about Sony. And Sony, yes, they are number one, but we are going to beat them up. Next page. Larry Ellison. Steve had decided, rather brilliantly, why should I compete with Microsoft and bang my head up against the wall when I can compete with Sony instead? We'd go on these long walks and said, who do you want to compete with, Microsoft or Sony? I'll take Sony every day of the week because I'm a software company and Sony is not. John Rubenstein. We knew that someone was going to replace the Walkman. Either we were or they were. Tony Fidel. And he would just skip around, so it was just this back and forth. He was riding the tide of momentum. Larry Ellison. Apple is a software company. Microsoft is a software company. But Sony was a hardware company. You can kill a hardware company because most hardware products, like an iPod, are 95% software. Tony Fidel. And then at the end, I had all these little mock-ups. I had bought these modern-day calculators and all the MP3 players, tore them apart and made little pieces, and I put the little bits all into the box, and I said, okay, here are the different battery technologies we could use. Here are the different storage types. Here are the different displays. Here are the different interfaces, boards, connectors, and basically assembled the different options in front of him. I did three different options of here is what they could look like. Here is what the cost could be. Those kinds of things. John Rubenstein. Tony was coached. Here's the choices we're going to present to Steve. Here's the order you present them in. Here's how you present it so that when we come to the end, we get the right answer, right? Tony Fidel. For the final option, which a bunch of us thought was the best option, I made a styrofoam model with laser printouts of what I thought would be the right interface and everything, and then weighted the model so it felt about the right size and everything. I then had all the little blocks that would go inside because I wanted to show that this was real enough. So I showed it to him. He picked it up, and he was like, okay. But then he said, but I do not think this is the right user interface for it. And then Phil goes, can we tell him? And Steve looks at me and goes, yeah, we can trust him. Because they were all Apple employees except me. I was a consultant. So Phil Schiller runs into Steve's office, picks out a device, and has the device in his hand, and says, see that? Look at that wheel. We want something like that on it. Do you think you can do that? Mike Slade. Phil had a Bang & Olufsen remote, because Phil was one of those guys with Bang & Olufsen stuff all over his house. And he brought in the remote and showed us the scroll wheel, which Bang & Olufsen never patented, by the way. And I remember being there going, you're right, this is cool. This is a really cool user interface. Tony Fadell. I looked at it and figured out in my brain how they did it. I was like, sure, we can add that. And Steve is like, all right, we're going to commit to this project. We're going to do it. And we want you to be the guy. And John looks at Steve and he goes, yeah, I will take care of it. And I go, look, I've got a startup company. And Steve is like, don't worry about that. We will take care of it. I was like, okay. I did not know what that meant. John Rubenstein. I went back to Tony. In front of the whole team, I said, okay, Tony, if you want to do this, you've got to join the company. I'm not going to do this with you as a consultant. So I kind of twisted his arm to take the job, basically. Guy Barnahum. Ruby is always cursing. He's a very ruthless and smart and disgusting person. And basically, according to the legend, he said to Tony, it's time to shit or get off the pot. And he did that to him in a very theatrical way, during a staff meeting in front of maybe 20, 25 people. And Ruby enjoyed putting Tony on the spot in a very, very public way. He told Tony, look, man, I'm not continuing this meeting. I've had enough. You either join or we just kill your project. John Rubenstein. It wasn't really true, but... Guy Barnahum. Tony was really put on the spot, and he really didn't know what to do. He kind of hesitated. Tony Fadell. I'm like, wait a second, I have a company, and there are people over there working on this other thing. How am I going to do this? I was just like, whoa. So I just got in my car, and I started driving through the hills of Saratoga and Los Gatos. So I go up to Skyline Drive. I wind up those roads, and I'm just sitting there going, what am I going to do? What am I doing? Apple had, they liked to say, single-digit market share. It was literally 1 to 1.5% of computer sales in the U.S. Nowhere else in the world, just in the U.S. 1.5%. And the stock had crashed. And I am like, why am I going to join Apple? I love the place, but why am I joining? Guy Barnahum. Why would he sell for cheap the iPod to Apple? Was it fear? I can't do it myself. I need a full company behind me to actually make it. Was it a discussion with Steve? Some reassurance? Tony Fadell. I had a very pointed conversation with Steve, going, look, let me tell you, I was at General Magic, and I watched them come out with a great product and not be able to market it and sell it. I'm going to pour my life into this. I'm going to build a team, but at the end of the day, when we're going to be up against Sony, how do I know you're going to be able to sell and market it? And Steve just said, look, I will devote the entire Mac advertising budget to this if you can pull this off. I said, really? And he goes, yes. John Rubenstein. Now, what startup is going to ever be able to do that, right? The Mac had a large installed base, a tremendous fan base that was very, very attached to Apple. Ron Johnson. This is about when the stores launched, May 2001. The stores had a good start in terms of the Mac faithful. John Rubenstein. We had a captive market, right? So if Apple released the iPod, and if we could get 10 or 20% of the installed base to buy iPods, it would be dramatically successful. Ron Johnson. But the challenge for the stores was not to serve the faithful, it was to reach new customers. And so the iPod was our chance to really make a difference. John Rubenstein. Our demographics were terrible. And we hoped the iPod would bring more younger people in. Tony Fadell. Now, everything is half-truths. So I was like, okay, Steve is saying the right things, but will he really do it? Then in the back of my head, I'm like, if we do not run like hell, we are going to get canceled. Because I saw so many projects get canceled. I'm like, I've got to build the team, and we've got to ship this by Christmas. Because if we do not ship by Christmas, we are dead as a product. It was 24/7 working for that 6 to 8 months. depending on how you count. Michael Dewey, he hardly ever slept. He would send emails at 2 or 3 in the morning. It gave the appearance that he was a vampire. John Rubenstein, the fear was Sony or some other big consumer electronics company was going to come after us and actually kick our butt, and so we kept the pace of innovation such that there was no way anyone was going to get in front of us. Guy Barnahum, we basically hired 20 or 30 people, some of them from inside Apple, all the lost souls within the company, people who had fought with their managers and needed something new to do. Michael Dewey, we were put in a separate building and we had security badges, so only people in our group could open the doors to our area. It was pretty high security. You couldn't tell anyone what you were working on. John Rubenstein, why give a heads up to your competitors? Why let Sony know you're working on an iPod? Guy Barnahum, it was, you show up, you have computers, you need to set up networks, and you can't really use the company because of secrecy, and you just don't know who to talk to. So you just do it yourself. It was all asses and elbows, and that's where we shined, really. Michael Dewey, the funny thing is that almost nothing on the iPod was actually done by Apple. Underneath the hood, it was a lot of stuff grabbed from other parts of the industry. Guy Barnahum, by luck, Tony found this one company that actually made platforms for MP3 players. I don't know why they did that, because there was no market for it. And that company was Portal Player in Kirkland, Washington. Sanjeev Kumar, we were from the PC industry. We had not done anything in consumer electronics, and frankly did not know much about MP3 music at the time, except that Napster was a big thing and lots of people were downloading digital music. Guy Barnahum, so they had a solution. Software and hardware, basically all of the under-the-hood stuff that you need in order to create an MP3 player. Sanjeev Kumar, we had the main processor and the hardware interfaces for all your storage devices, displays, and input devices. In addition, we had all the software to run the processor. It was something we've been working on for 2 years. Guy Barnahum, the other part was Pixo. Pixo was a bunch of geezers that left Apple to create a software framework for cell phones, and we needed this kind of technology for iPod. Andy Grignan. So, some friends of ours from Apple reached out. They said, hey, we're making this new thing and we'd like to see if we could use your software. Can you make us an example application? And we were like, all right, what do you guys want? They were like, just a sample MP3 player. I'm like, great. So we whipped up a sample MP3 player app. But what was funny was we didn't know what we were building. We never saw the form factor. We never saw anything. It was just, make your stuff work, and that was it. Obviously, it was an iPod, right? But we just made a sample app. And to this day, in every iPod that's ever shipped, TMP3 sample app is what gets launched when you turn on your iPod. Guy Barnahum, we took all these code bases and we just very hackily kind of threw them together with bubblegum and masking tape. We put them together in a very haphazard way because if you have a finite amount of time, right, a finite amount of resources, you really lower the bar on the software, right? You bring it in. Sanjeev Kumar, Apple was very pragmatic. They had their date to launch, and they had absolutely no problem in dropping a feature if that feature was going to be a roadblock to shipping on that date. Obviously, you can't ship something that doesn't work. But the iPod specs in the beginning and what we launched were two very different things. Guy Barnahum, and it worked, but if you challenged it a little bit, it was going to crash. So we shipped software that was really alpha level. Sanjeev Kumar, that first iPod was really a science project. John Rubenstein, we had to get it done. Wayne Goodrich, the evening before the launch, Steve was looking at it and playing with it, and John Rubenstein was walking up the aisle, and Just as John got there, Steve pushed his glasses up on his head and looked at the screen, and he goes, "You know, I really wish we'd been able to get color on this thing." And then John just patted him on the back and said, "Next version, Steve, next version." Mike Slade. The introduction was in that little tiny town hall war room, and it wasn't even very crowded. Stephen Levy. I was in New York working at Newsweek. We were consumed by 9/11, so I wasn't going to go to California for, you know, what seemed at the time like not a major product announcement. Mike Slade. 9/11 happened a month before the iPod came out. Stephen Levy. Apple asked me if I wanted one, and of course I did, so they hand-delivered it to me the day it was released. It came with CDs because they didn't want us to steal music to put on it, so they figured that in case we didn't own CDs, they would give us a stack of them. All Steve Jobs's favorite music. Bob Dylan Live, 1966. Glenn Gould's Goldberg Variations. That night or the night after, I was going to a Microsoft event in New York. The latest version of Windows was going to come out. So I brought my iPod and sat next to Bill Gates at the dinner and pulled it out of my pocket and said, "Have you seen this?" And he said, "No." And I handed it to him. And he fiddled with the dials and played with it, trying to understand it. It was like he was an alien that had the power to suck up all the information on a piece of technology. So there's this little tunnel between him and the iPod, and he got all the information, and he handed it back to me and said, "This is only for Macintosh?" Mike Slade. People forget that it was designed as a Mac-only, niche-y add-on. No power cord, assume FireWire. All these things that no self-respecting MBA would ever greenlight, because it limited the market size. Steve didn't care. He just wanted it to be good. Ron Johnson. So it really wasn't a product for Windows people. If they wanted an iPod, they'd have to buy a Mac. John Rubenstein. The goal of the iPod was not to change Apple at the time. The goal was to sell more Macs. You bought your iPod, so you'd spend money on that. And that then locked you into the Mac ecosystem. Stephen Levy. I liked it from the beginning. To me, the most exciting thing about the iPod was the shuffle thing. You could take all your music and shuffle it, and it would all be yours, but there would be the element of surprise, too. It was like a radio station where every single selection was a song you liked. To me, it was a metaphor for the digital age. A symbol of the promise of the digital age. John Rubenstein. We only sold a few hundred thousand of that first product. Ron Johnson. So the iPod was not successful. It was a good product, but a low-value product from 2001 to 2004. Stephen Levy. In 2004, I noticed the thing was taking off in a cultural sense. The iPod itself was a thing. You would walk through the streets, and you would see someone else with these white earbuds, and it was like a secret society. You were part of this cult. The iPod was a fetish object, an object of lust for the people who owned it. It could deliver music better than anything before it. The fact that it looked beautiful just amplified how much people loved it. Sanjeev Kumar. Even though the initial volume for the first few years of iPod were not that big, and the revenues were not that big, it created the halo effect. Apple products became cool again. Ron Johnson. But the iPod wouldn't have changed the music world without the iTunes Music Store. Mike Slade. The iTunes Music Store comes in late 03. John Rubenstein. The iTunes Music Store allowed you to actually buy a track at a time for 99 cents. And download the music directly in iTunes, so you didn't have to buy CDs or records or anything else anymore. You could download directly from the store and get the latest music. So it was very cool and pretty exciting. Mike Slade. Steve is the one who made it happen because at first the labels just said no to everything. They were just like, "Yes, we're doing our own thing, fuck off," over and over. They were the worst people I've ever dealt with in the entire galaxy. But Steve convinced them to let him do it on the Mac. John Rubinstein. We put together a pitch to the music companies. Look, we're at 2% market share with the Mac. We are not successful. So you have no downside to licensing us the music. You can do this experiment and it will cost you nothing. If we've been wildly successful in the market, there's no way they would have licensed it to us. We didn't matter. So they could license it to us, and who cares, right? Run the experiment. What do you have to lose? If you don't do this, it's just going to get stolen anyway. And so we kind of got away with it because it didn't matter. Now they probably ended up doing deals they probably regretted later. But that's how it all kind of played out. Nolan Bushnell. I tried to do a digital jukebox in 1992 or 93, and to get the rights from the record companies was just impossible. Fast forward 10 years. Steve got all four of the major record labels to let him sell tracks for 99 cents. That was a negotiation, and I really appreciated that he was able to do that, because I had gone down that same path and failed. So you gotta say, attaboy, Steve. Sean Parker. It turns out that it's a lot easier to get a deal done with the record labels after their business has collapsed. The music business went from a $45 billion global industry to a $12 billion global industry. It's a much easier conversation at that point. There is no hypothetical. You don't have to get them to believe that this catastrophic event is going to occur. It's already occurred. Ali Ayar. The iPod took advantage of the fact that Napster existed. The fact that you could put 1,000 songs in your pocket? Where are you getting 1,000 songs? John Rubinstein. People were stealing music, yes, no question about it. Steve Wozniak. Then Steve did a strange thing. Ron Johnson. Several members of the executive team, most notably Phil Schiller and probably John Rubinstein, convinced Steve to open up the product to Windows. That was like heresy to Steve. Steve Wozniak. He went open. Ron Johnson. Mac was a closed ecosystem, right? But he made the decision to open it up to Windows. Steve Wozniak. He okayed it. He said, you don't have to have a Macintosh to use an iPod. We'll write iTunes for Windows. Mike Slade. People didn't really think that the iPod was going to be a viable product for Windows because it was a pain in the butt to hook it up to FireWire. It was kind of a hack for a Windows user until the USB 2.0 iPod came out. That's one of the reasons why the music companies were willing to give him the Windows option. John Rubinstein. By then it was, you're kind of pregnant, so it is too late to back out now. Ron Johnson. It was a huge economic impact for the music industry because before, if you used to have a great song, you'd get $15 because you sold a record. Now that song was worth 99 cents. It disaggregated the album. Guy Barnahome. iPod basically freed Apple from the PC wars. Apple was entrenched in this losing war. It was like World War I, suffering and bleeding and losing territory and losing cultural relevance, until iPod came and opened up the big sky of the universal app that is music. Today it looks small, but back then it was infinitely bigger. Music crosses cultures and operating systems, and everything that was limiting the growth of Apple. It was a big thing. Steve Wozniak. Apple didn't grow in size ever over the Apple II days until the iPod, and it didn't grow in size when he introduced the iMac. It all started with the iPod, and it was the openness. Sanjeev Kumar. It brought Apple back from the brink. Andy Hertzfeld. They were making literally billions every week from the handheld music players. Ron Johnson. The iPod gave Steve confidence that when we're not competing with a monopoly, Apple could win. because we got up to almost 90% market share on music players. Steve Wozniak. The openness made our revenues double, our profits double, our stock double, and the board gave him billions of dollars in stock and 8 jet airplanes. Ron Johnson. So the feeling was, wow, we can do this. Eve Behar. Before the iPod, you couldn't really go to any meeting anywhere and say, look, design is important and central to a business. We couldn't go do that as designers because the minute you would say this to Microsoft, Compaq, HP, anybody in the business, they would laugh you out of the room because you were basically taking the example of a loser, Apple. So the iPod really is what put design front and center. It really gave the hardware guys a show-off moment, a win. Jordan Ritter. Of course, I had wanted it to be Napster, but I didn't really care. I knew that someone would break through all these asinine people, companies and industries that were saying no. And there it was. There it was, finally. The more philosophically minded had a different reaction. They felt that Jobs had sold out. He saved Apple, yes, but that big win came at a big cost. Jobs betrayed the power to the people ideals that had animated his youth, early Apple, and the personal computer movement as a whole. John Markov. I was super disappointed. For me, iTunes meant that the PC was becoming an entertainment device. I was still back in the bicycle of the mind world. For me, it was about augmentation. Steve, where are the better tools for writers and thinkers? We actually had that conversation, and he blew me off. Alan Kay. When Steve came back to Apple, he was not the same Steve. He was a very effective Steve, but he had lost his zeal for what computers are really good for socially, like education. Completely lost it. And you know, I would try to get him back interested in Wheels for the Mind. Remember that, Steve? Instead of dumbed-down user interfaces. John Markov. Steve didn't look backward very much. Next and the Mac were really targeted at this notion of augmentation that Engelbart had thought up years before. Computers were these tools that could really enhance your ability to do intellectual work. Steve was turning the computer into a new entertainment device. First with audio, but later with video. John Rubinstein. The early Steve was the bicycle for the mind thing. How do you enhance human creativity, human capabilities by using computers? With the iPod, that got extended into how do you make people's lives better? The side effect, of course, was that people tuned out. Steve Wozniak. To me, it looks like, oh my gosh, they could walk out in front of a car. You think a whole bunch of negative thoughts because you've grown up another way, but it's really not bad. It's just different. They have their way, we have ways from the past, and they can be very, totally different. And yet, that doesn't make one of the ways bad compared to the other. Alan Kay. I used to get after Steve, and he didn't care, because he was selling it to people who were just happy to continue the dumbing down. It's bad, really bad. Most people can't see it. People don't have any idea what a computer is. They are just using it to play movies on. This is the corruption of consumer electronics, using a computer basically for convenience rather than for actually doing primary needs. If you think about it, this is completely fucked up. I'm feeling lucky. Google cracks the code. Google was a dot-com poster child. But unlike the others, it managed to escape immolation in the dot bomb. Brin and Page had the good fortune to secure $25 million of venture money in 1999, just before the fever broke. They also had the good sense to bank most of those millions. It took them a few years to figure out how to make search profitable. But again, luck was on their side. The money sustained the young company through the launch of AdWords, a self-service ad-buying tool in 2001. 2 years later, Google perfected their advertising system with AdSense, which turned the entire internet into a billboard that Google could then sell. The timing was again perfect. Google became enormously profitable at the very moment that the rest of the valley was at its most desperate. Google was able to expand on the cheap. With ad money pouring in, Brin and Page went on a buying spree, sucking whole companies, buildings by the dozen, and thousands of PhDs into their ever-expanding headquarters, the Googleplex. The much-anticipated Google IPO in 2004 marks the start of what Silicon Valley calls Web 2.0, a reboot, a leveling up, a phase shift. Post-Google, the Valley began to abandon the notion of the Internet as a free cyberspace that one could surf, and instead started to regard the web as a vast machine, possessed of a native intelligence which it could direct, program, and even own. Douglas Edwards. If you read Larry and Sergey's original paper that they wrote at Stanford where they talked about creating a search engine, they specifically said that advertising was wrong and bad, and it would inherently corrupt the search engine if you sold advertising. So they were adamantly opposed to the notion of having advertising on Google. Ray Sidney. So when I originally met Larry and Sergey in 1999, the plan was to license search. No advertising. We were going to have the best search out there and portals and companies and whatnot, and we were going to license it.
Marissa Mayer. The first revenue came on June 24, 1999, and it was licensing. Netscape was basically paying Google to power their search.
Larry Page. OEMing a search. You can get revenue from that, but it is limited. People aren't used to paying huge amounts of money for that. Ray Sidney. Then people started reading about how much money was being brought into various other companies by search advertising, and it was kind of decided that we were leaving money on the table. Douglas Edwards. There was a lot of pressure to generate revenue, and so Larry and Sergey decided that advertising doesn't have to be evil if it's actually useful and relevant. Ray Sidney. We had this great website, and that was really getting popular, so maybe we should think about putting some ads up there? Let's try it out. Thus was born the first Google ad server. They had to call companies. Hey, would you like to advertise on Google? It was a manual process. The first ads were July or August of 99. David Cheriton. The thing that many people don't recall from that first web era was that a lot of the companies that started out as search companies introduced advertising and then compromised the search in favor of the advertising, so nobody trusted the search. Paul Buckheit. Companies would just mix the ads in with the regular search results, so people would think it was a search result. It's kind of like fake news or something. Brad Templeton. In most of the publishing business, there is a history of having a wall between editorial and advertising. Google really took that to heart. They tried to keep their wall between the advertisement and the actual editorial content pretty strictly divided. But all the other websites were basically tearing down the wall. Google said, let's not do that. Douglas Edwards. That was something Larry and Sergey were adamantly opposed to. They felt that it was so corrupt and so disingenuous. It was like a religious thing with them. So they wanted to make sure that nobody would mistake Google Ads for search results. Paul Buckheit. Sometime in early 2000, there was a meeting to decide on the company's values. They invited a collection of people who had been there for a while. I was sitting there trying to think of something that would be really different, and not one of these usual strive-for-excellence sort of statements. I also wanted something that, once you get it in there, would be hard to take out. Brad Templeton. Don't be evil, was the phrase. Paul Buckeye. It just sort of occurred to me. Sergey Brin. We have tried to define precisely what it means to be a force for good. Always do the right ethical thing. Ultimately, don't be evil seems the easiest way to summarize it. Paul Buckeye. It's also a bit of a jab at the other companies, especially our competitors, who at the time were, in our opinion, kind of exploiting the users to some extent. They were tricking them by selling search results, which we considered a questionable thing to do, because people didn't realize that they were ads. Sergey Brin. We think that's a slippery slope. Brad Templeton. That's what being evil would be, actually. Scott Hassan. Then Larry came up with a great idea, having self-serve ads, where you could just go to a website and click a couple things, and then ads would be shown on the Google website without talking to a salesperson at all.
Marissa Mayer. AdWords was pay by credit card and we're going to run your ad.
Ray Sidney. That's definitely important. You can call the big advertisers and say, hey, how would you like to start advertising with us? But you can't call up all the little people who are interested in spending a small amount of money to advertise whatever small things they're selling, what you would call the long tail. So that was definitely key. Douglas Edwards. One of the key innovations was that the ads were going to be created by the advertisers themselves and not in any way be vetted by Google. I thought that that was absolutely insane. I was sure that was suicide, and I told Larry as much. And so we did it anyway. We put it up on the homepage as a link, and about 2 hours after we did that, we got our first AdWords customer, Lively Lobsters in Kingston, Rhode Island. Ryan Bartholomew was the owner and sole employee. Ryan Bartholomew. I didn't even know what I was doing. I just thought it was cool to buy lobsters for $5 off the boat and try to ship them to buyers. And I was just working around the clock trying to figure out ways to get my listing out there. This was back in the days of Yahoo and AltaVista, and I don't even remember the others. But Google was around and very new, and I was up at 2 in the morning playing around on Google looking for something or other. David Cheriton. The web had grown from this very early stage, where there was a small amount of content and you could sort of find things with the help of Yahoo, to the case where the content had grown so rapidly and had attracted all of these compromisers and game players that it became harder and harder to find things. And so that was the environment that Google was in. Ryan Bartholomew. And there was this little box to the side that was looking for advertisers for Google. I had never seen that before, and I ended up clicking on it and running an ad for Live Lobsters. I later found out that I was the first advertiser on Google, ever. It was a self-serve, all-text display ad. You bid on a keyword, and you make the ad, and you pay a certain amount for it. Ray Sidney. So in a very real sense, every time you do a search query on Google, an auction happens behind the scenes between the various advertisers that are interested in keywords that are in the query. Ryan Bartholomew. Because you are bidding competitively against other people for keywords, it was priced in CPM. Brad Templeton. That's cost per thousand views. $10 is a very common CPM in the marketplace. If you prefer to think of it as cost per view, you can think of that as a penny per view. But usually people use the cost per thousand. M is the Latin for 1,000. Ryan Bartholomew. I spent $83, and as far as I could tell, I didn't get a single order. I was pretty pissed off. I ended up calling Google, and I got somebody, and I said, this sucks. Brad Templeton. For many years, nobody was able to really get advertisers to pay very much. So, basically, the philosophy of sites at the time was, yes, what can we do for you, sir? And so you had web pages, and they'd have pop-ups and pop-unders and dancing bears and everything else, and whatever the advertisers would pay for, you would do. Ryan Bartholomew. I asked them, why aren't you doing pay for click? Why aren't you charging per click rather than just on the number of impressions? I didn't get anything for my ads. So they took my feedback, and that was that. Brad Templeton. So I want to pay per click. Ryan Bartholomew. And after a while, they did move to a pay-per-click model.
Marissa Mayer. It was, we're going to let you pay per click.
Brad Templeton. And again, the other sites are doing it. Ryan Bartholomew. GoTo.com was the first pay-per-click engine. It was a company called FindWhat.com. It was this whole pay-per-click ad model around prior to Google, and I had already been doing pretty well with it.
Marissa Mayer. But we're going to rank your ad based on a quality score and how much you are willing to pay.
Brad Templeton. The brilliant thing that Google said was, okay, pay-per-click, but if people do not click on your ad, we're not running it. Google charges you a fee if someone clicks on your ad, but if your ad is not performing enough, they take you out of the way, so they end up getting a minimum for every 1,000 impressions they do. Therefore, they won't run your ad unless it's paying them the CPM figure they want. That was the genius. Google found a way that the advertiser could think that they were paying per click, which is what advertisers like, but they, the publisher of the website, could get paid per 1,000 views, which is what publishers like. They found this marriage, which gave them what they wanted and gave the advertisers the illusion that they were getting what they wanted. And of course, who wins? Google wins. Ryan Bartholomew. It was called AdWords Select. Brad Templeton. And this was, by that standard of that day, a complete shock. What do you mean you won't take my money? That was just a completely foreign idea to web advertising at the time, and it forced all the advertisers to write good ads that people would actually click on. Douglas Edwards. And it wasn't just advertising for lobsters. Ryan quickly understood the opportunity for arbitrage. Amazon had an affiliate program where if you sent someone to Amazon and they bought a book, Amazon would pay you. So Ryan began taking ads out on Google, not just for lobsters, but for books that would link to his Amazon affiliate page, where he would collect commissions. And of course, in the same way he was using Amazon to generate revenue, he began linking to adult sites that were paying for traffic. Ryan Bartholomew. I just couldn't make much money on the lobsters, so in 2001 I ended up selling that company and ended up focusing on porn, basically. Google allowed you to bid on adult keywords and run traffic to the porn affiliate programs, which get people to give their credit card and sign up for a free trial and all that stuff. It was a really simple business model. I would bid on any sex-related keyword that I could get. Traffic was cheap, especially for the obscure stuff, and I would send it to a page that was nothing but text links. It would break down whatever their interest was, any kind of fetish, and then they would click it, and it would take them to a porn site targeted to that interest. At one point, there must have been 40 or 50 affiliate programs for everything under the sun. Brad Templeton. I remember the first party they had after they moved to downtown Palo Alto, where they had actually put a projector doing search queries onto the sidewalk of University Avenue, and that's how you knew where it was. David Cheriton. And one of them showed me his laptop or some display where you could see the searches that were being filtered out, and of course they were all sort of porn-type searches. Without the filter, we would have all been arrested. And it just sort of struck me. I hadn't really thought about the magnitude of the use of the search engine for searching for porn. Ryan Bartholomew. The beauty of it is that it didn't matter whether it was lobsters, porn, Aerosmith CDs, or snowblowers. It was all just arbitrage on the value of the traffic. This is what Google was built upon. This is ultimately what Google is. You take a general search and filter it by what people are interested in. The more accurately you can figure out what people are searching for, the more likely they are to buy that product or service. Amazon is kind of doing that, too. It's a very sophisticated machine for the same idea, narrowing you down to exactly what you want. Young Harville. It's still not really talked about a lot in Silicon Valley, but a lot of the killer app for some of the first technologies is porn. Ryan Bartholomew. I remember spending $13,000 in one day on all adult-oriented traffic, and my margins on that traffic were something like three times, so I must have made $30,000 or $40,000 in one day. That was right at the peak. Brad Templeton. This turned into Google's great advertising success. Ryan Bartholomew. And when the holidays rolled around, I got a lava lamp from Google as a thank you gift for sending them millions of dollars in business. Scott Hassan. But AdWords was just about putting ads on the Google search engine. The real advance was AdSense in 2003.
Marissa Mayer. Which was, because you are paying per click or per lead, now we're going to take your ad and put it on different websites.
Paul Buckeit. AdSense, the content-targeted ads, was actually something that, if I recall, I did on a Friday. It was an idea that we had talked about for a long time, but there was this belief that somehow it wouldn't work. But it seemed like an interesting problem, so one evening I implemented this content-targeting system, just as a sort of a side project, not because I was supposed to, and it turned out to work. Susan Wojcicki. It was a really novel idea at the time to serve ads that were targeted dynamically. People were saying, this is a sports site, so we'll serve a sports ad. And we were saying, no, we can actually look at the page in real time and figure out what this page is about. Paul Buckeit. What I wrote was just a throwaway prototype, but it got people thinking because it proved that it was possible. And that it wasn't too hard, because I was able to do it in less than a day. After that, other people took over and did all the hard work of making it into a real product. Ryan Bartholomew. AdSense is just the inverse of AdWords. With AdWords, you are paying for when the ad is clicked on. Then you get that traffic, and then it's up to you how you make money on that traffic. AdSense is just the program where, if you're the publisher of a web page, you get a cut of what those AdWords buyers are spending. It's like owning a billboard. You run AdSense if you owned a billboard, and the person who is buying the ad on the billboard would be an AdWords customer, and Google is the middleman. Douglas Edwards. Google manages the system. They collect both the advertisers and the sites that run the ads. And so there's a viral effect that goes into play when you build a critical mass. The advertisers say, where are all the publishers? Well, they're at Google. And the publishers say, where are the most advertisers? Oh, they're at Google. So it feeds on itself until you become the predominant player in that space. Ev Williams. That's when Google came knocking. It was a really hard decision to sell Blogger to Google because Google was still private. No one knew what was going to happen. This was pre-Gmail, pre-anything but search and advertising. So that was confusing. Why would they want to buy Blogger? We're not a search engine. Douglas Edwards. It was really simple. Once we had AdSense, we wanted more places to put ads. And we thought Blogger was going to generate millions of pages of content on which we could put ads. Scott Hassan. It expanded the reach that their ad network had and allowed them to have a lot of inventory cheaply. It was a win-win for everybody. Biz Stone. After Google acquired Blogger, I wrote an email to Ev, and I said to him, I feel like I'm the missing member of your team. And so if you ever need to hire more people for the Blogger team, I'm your guy. I was actually hired to be on the AdSense team, or whatever it was called in 2003, but I really worked on Blogger under Ev. Ev Williams. and we had to go down to Mountain View because that's where the real Silicon Valley was. Biz Stone, we were in Building Pi, of course. Nerd Factory, right? Brad Templeton, and by that point they had become a pretty